Hello, welcome to your Politics RTE's Politics Podcast. I'm Anya Lawler. With me are political staff Paul Cunningham, Sandra Hurley, Micheál Dehaene. And I know it's budget week. Sorry I missed talking to you all Tuesday when you were going through all of that. But the big story, I suppose, of the week, hasn't it been? It was the Wednesday night meeting of the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party meeting. Some of the reports that have emerged since, Micheál, you were writing about it overnight and this morning, it sounded almost as if you could have put it to music.
Yes, a degree of drama and a degree of humility. So, more a soap, really, isn't it? The sudden character change and a soap, maybe that wouldn't even be a very good one, where the character can alter so quickly. Micheál Martin, between Monday on the 6-1 news, where there still was a degree of swagger and spreading out the blame, that was long gone. And instead, what you got was the fleeting, it seems, breaking of the voice as he said sorry and the hands shaking as well. So all the things you don't associate with Micheál Martin. But that's what was required. And that set a tone of humility, which made the thing way more kind of even measured than had been anticipated. But still, like, more than 50 people got up to speak. All the middle ground spoke. Yes, they were polite, but equally critical of the selection process. And a marker has clearly been set down now. Now, whether Micheál Martin sees that marker or not, I suspect he doesn't, given the effort that went into the presentation, given the fact that you had apparently communications experts ringing ministers asking what could the leader do to improve his internal messaging. This remains a very determined man, even if some people think that at the end of the EU presidency in 2026, it's that point on that the changeover has to come into view. I think privately he's absolutely thinks this is nonsense.
So no heave, Sandra, a committee to review what went wrong.
Yes, the review back in a few weeks, we're told, some talk of external experts coming in to advise on that and better processes for the next selection for the presidential election. But I do think Micheál Martin is wounded over all of this, because there have been other parliamentary party meetings where there was a lot of talk beforehand. He's talked them down previously when there's been a lot of unhappy people in the parliamentary party and talk of heaves. But this time, when it comes to the debacle of the selection of Jim Gavin's as a candidate for Fianna Fáil, Micheál Martin pretty much anointed him. It all falls to him and he has to shoulder a giant share of the blame. He did do that at the parliamentary party meeting. From speaking to people who were there, they say he seemed genuinely humble. He seemed genuinely gutted. He did disarm them, I think, because he spoke for so long at the start. To several people, it kind of took the heat out of it. And some people who you might have expected to go on the attack did hold back and weren't quite as fiery as was predicted. But yes, lots of people made their unhappiness known. There was a lot of kind of linen aired at the meeting, a lot of it leaking out to journalists. But I think he is wounded from all of this. Of course, the question is, when does something happen? Does something happen at some point? Yes, that timeline is being talked about in early 2027. Some talk in the party that they want to have a new person in to have a stint as Taoiseach before the changeover happens in November 2027. And that person would then become Taoiseach there. But we've got a while to go before that happens.
There was one moment, in the meeting where Micheál Martin is very polite, but he does start interrupting Paddy O'Sullivan when Paddy O'Sullivan's giving a written timeline of how last weekend unfolded the chaotic events, and he keeps trying to interrupt. And it's Pat the Cope Gallagher intervenes from the floor and demands that Brendan Smith shut the leader down, and that's duly what happened, which kind of shows you where the power dynamic was at that meeting.
Just on the, I think...
I don't think your anecdote's going to be as good as that one, but fire away.
Stop. I'll just stop.
You're not running for the press.
I'm not fighting on anecdotes. It was just an opinion in which I was actually going to agree with you. I might actually go against myself now, but I think the chance that Micheál Martin as Taoiseach and Uachtaráin Fianna Fáil is somehow going in January of 2027 saying, do you know what, for the good of the party, the best thing that's happened is I hand over to someone else. The chances of that are nil.
I've had a good presidency.
Exactly. It's far more likely to be the end of that year. He retains the Taoiseach position and then you are looking, you know, 2-year cycle into the general election, and I think that's when any changer will happen. Him handing over his Taoiseach, he'll have to be taken out with his boots on.
But the would-be rebels or the malcontents or the however you want to describe them, they didn't have a leader because Big Jim O'Callaghan wasn't willing to wield the knife. Isn't that right?
Yeah, they didn't get the signal, and there was some of them furiously in search of that signal for a few days, but it was clearly the opposite. And people were brought into line in that way. And I think that's where the degree of calm came from. But as Sandra's point, there is that huge middle ground, the people who usually don't speak at these meetings. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the past, even the one down in Cavan, there weren't a lot of speakers going against Micheál Martin. So while his leadership wasn't directly threatened, there is clearly a difference there. Some of the justifications too, I think the most, well, you could call it eloquent, but certainly comprehensive one came from James Lawless when he spoke about Jim Gavin being very good on paper, but they didn't know that he wouldn't have confidence on screen or in debates. But he's saying what he was going to do is, and this was the logic, he was going to form a coalition between the Defence Forces, the GAA, Dublin and Fianna Fáil in what he described as an almost unbeatable force.
On paper. There are a couple of questions.
He's still on paper, of course.
Yes, exactly. There are a couple of things I really don't understand here, and I'm not sure that we've heard any explanation of this yet from Fianna Fáil. Why did Fianna Fáil and Jim Gavin, each of them, not put this to bed when they first got the query from Fionnán Sheehan in The Independent? He says that was the 8th of September that query went into Fianna Fáil. Why was this issue not dealt with, the truth told, sort? They could have paid the debt. They could have sorted it all out and at least had a story in that regard. And then why? Let Jim Gavin come on The Week in Politics last Sunday when they knew from talking to Niall Donald himself on the Saturday, they knew that there was substance to this story. They knew there was a problem. I mean, they could have said he'd fallen downstairs. They could have said he'd got COVID. But to leave him swing...
You're not suggesting someone would be lying now on your lawyer.
Yeah, I think there's some dark chatter that they allowed him to go on because they knew it would be completely irreversible once he gave that kind of equivocation as he did to you and you pressed him. It was very clear he wasn't going to confirm either way. He was trying to put some context around this story, saying I was in financial difficulty at the time, as was my family, as were a lot of people. But he wouldn't confirm whether he still owed the money. He sort of said he was looking into it, but he really kind of hung himself on that answer because he left it open. He didn't shut it down. And that was that.
And the other question, though, as well, was Jack Chambers the right campaign manager for the presidential campaign when he had a budget to prepare? And I mean, what kind of, you know, you thought that Fianna Fáil in the olden days, they used to have a certain kind of reputation for a certain kind of professionalism. Doesn't all of this add up to amateur hour?
Well, two questions there, because do you want to feel the September the 8th one or Jack? Because the September 8th one, just for, you mentioned it first came up and the request went in. And what we have been told from Fianna Fáil was that they did go to their candidate and say, there seems to be a question about an issue you have with the tenant. And the person said, that's Jim Gavin, said, no, I don't.
And that was it. Nobody went away and checked.
Apparently, they said they went back to the journalists as well and asked for more specifics.
Exactly. And they weren't forthcoming.
Yes.
There were public records.
They believed Jim Gavin. I suppose they did believe Jim Gavin. I suppose. And at that point, why wouldn't you?
What is it? Truth but verify? Yeah. And The question about Jack Chambers, and it's also relevant because, of course, Jack Chambers has in many ways, hasn't he, been Micheál Martin's kind of anointed one, you know, the heir apparent, almost like Brian Cowan was with Bertie Ahern.
Jack is GA. Jack likes football. This would all work, wouldn't it? You know, it was tapping all those things.
But he was overburdened, I think, in time-wise. And even I was working at the weekend, the budget stuff was being signed off on Sunday. It was very clear there was a problem because, of course, he was embroiled in the Jim Gavin trying to sort that out, that whole problem on Sunday afternoon. And all those departmental allocations, those spending allocations went into Monday. Now, usually the social welfare, social protection stuff goes on into Monday. You might have a few straggling bits that go into the Monday. But on Sunday, clearly he was completely preoccupied and he was overstretched. But it does seem that perhaps he wanted to do this because we understand that he was probably involved in some way in the selection as well of Jim Gavin.
I think with bats, I mean, the obvious thing was to hand it out over to someone like Dara O'Brien. I mean,
Jack mightn't have wanted that, though. I mean, it was going to be a winning ticketure, of course, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Another win. And he was director elections for the locals.
But as a leadership, whatever about his saying, I want it? I mean, surely up you go and you've got a job.
Okay.
There it is.
It's very quiet around here. Before we go on to the two candidates who are remaining in the campaign, it's very quiet around here for a budget week, isn't it? There's not much sense of post-budget excitement.
No euphoria, no big whooping from the backbenches. It was a sort of a bit of a limp budget. It was well trailed where the emphasis was going to be on investment, on those tax cuts. Definitely unpopular with the wider population. it goes against all the sort of normal political calculation. Normally you try and give something in terms of income tax cuts to all those people who go out and vote, and they probably go out and vote for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. So I think the government has very much decided this is year one in the electoral cycle. They're going to take the hit. They'll open up the purse strings more for those income tax cuts later on. But this time they're going to put the emphasis on services, on investment. But the one that's kind of mind-boggling, I think, to a lot of people is the tax cut for the hospitality industry. Some within the industry weren't even happy with the fact that it was going to come in July. Fiscal Council pointing out that the cut is more likely to be absorbed by the businesses to keep the businesses open. They're not going to pass it on to the customer. So it really only satisfies a very small sector. The government making the argument that this is about safeguarding jobs and keeping companies open. But it handed all those budget lines about McDonald's and Beef Barons and the McBudget over to the opposition. So we heard a lot of that on Tuesday.
I mean, just on picking up on what you said there, Sandra, just in relation to loosening the purse strings later on, I mean, it was immediately after the budget came out, the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council has warned that the figures included in the budget mean that net government spending will rise by 11.9% this year. And the council said this is much faster than the sustainable growth rate of an Irish economy, suggesting that if we are expanding and if we are taking a risk, there's increased possibilities of something going wrong. And if it goes wrong, well, guess what? You won't be able to open up those purse strings, and you could have a very different type of budget coming up 1, 2, 3 years' time.
And look at the surplus. The surplus is decreasing. The surplus now for next year is predicted to be 5 billion. Now, that sounds like a great cushion, but not when you're taking in, you know, billions upon billions, much greater amounts in those windfall taxes. So the windfall taxes are clearly paying for everything, and they're not going to hang around forever.
And whatever about the economists, I noticed Michael Healy-Ray and Sean Canny were welcoming that VAT cut for the hospitality industry and saying it would be good for rural tourism. So swings and roundabouts.
Yeah,
there,
and I think
suppose,
it seems it was agreed at the time of the programme for government talks at that stage, and it seems pretty clear that those independent ministers were on board with it and they helped get it over the line as well.
The other big VAT cut, and of course there wasn't one in personal income tax, was for on apartments. We're back to trying to deliver build to rent apartments when paying those rents for people who are looking for places to live doesn't add up most of the time. You'd be better off paying a mortgage, even at the inflated prices we've got now. It makes you kind of scratch your head about housing delivery, doesn't it?
Well, according to the Minister for Housing, who's on Morning Ireland this week, James Brown, it comes back to that mantra of government, which is supply. If you have more supply, then by the very nature of the market, it's going to bring prices down, whether that is for rents or whether that is for buying a home. The difficulty for the government, obviously, is that their targets are not being met. We can't see that supply, and no one believes that by making a cut in the very short term, that that will be offered back to the renters. So you're stuck. And this is going to be, it was the big issue for the last coalition government. It's the big issue for this one as well. And it was notable that even when they were doing that, something like that in relation to the corporate sector, they didn't offset it with something notably saying, but we recognise that homelessness is one of the greatest challenges we have. More than 5,000 children in emergency accommodation, and we're going to do this. They didn't offset it.
Or the renters' credit either.
You know, it didn't make sense to me.
And the opposition certainly pressing the point about, you know, the lack of cost of living supports this year and the impact that will have on people with, you know, their food bills, their energy bills, all of their bills, accommodation. All.
Mary Lou McDonald even borrowing the Fine Gael phrase about the people who get up early in the morning getting nothing out of this budget. But that's it. It's that huge cohort of the population that don't get anything.
And that will go on biting through the winter. And we'll see what effect that has on the government's popularity. But in terms of this presidential election campaign, budget moving the dial in any way?
Well, you couldn't see how it would be beneficial to Heather Humphreys, the last remaining government candidate, properly in the race. I mean, definitely, given that people are angry, given that that's what's coming back through when the ministers went in for their phoner yesterday. So it couldn't be beneficial. In some ways, it's such a large group of people angry compared to a small group. Typically, when something really emerges out of a budget, you know, a major controversy, I think this will ultimately be more stinging. It might just take time to see it.
Yeah, we haven't seen any banana skins yet, but it could have a long-term kind of frosting.
Given the numbers, yeah.
Yeah. So the presidential campaign, where are we? We've two left, although three names on the ballot paper.
Yeah, I mean, that is a bit farcical, and I think it does really cap the embarrassment for Fianna Fáil that Jim Gavin is going to be on the paper. question is, you know, how many votes will he actually get? Some in Fianna Fáil saying that they will vote for him. I think Joe Flaherty today said that. I think he has to reach 12.5% for Fianna Fáil to get some of that money back. Will they reach that point? Pádraig Tobin making the point that if you vote for him in protest, then he says you're writing a cheque to Fianna Fáil because it would be better, he would say, if they don't get the money back. So yes, we're back to the two candidates. I think it is absolutely that opposite ends of the ideological spectrum. And you can see Fine Gael today really turning up the heat on the attacks on Catherine Connolly. They've been accused of resorting to smear tactics. Catherine Connolly has accused them of being scared. There was comment about this. She was asked on News Talk about would she employ somebody who had been convicted of rape. That, of course, followed on from the Airgee story. And she said she'd have to think about that. And today she has come back and said she wouldn't employ anybody who was on the sex offenders register. But in the meantime, you saw the Health Minister, Jennifer Carroll McNeill, put out a statement really strongly going on the attack, calling this completely unacceptable. And also, I think, trying to share out the blame to the female opposition party leaders who are backing Catherine Connolly. She named them Holly Kearns, Mary Lou McDonald, Ivana Bacik, saying, how can you support this person? And Ivana Bacik has hit back hard this afternoon. So it seems we are getting into that territory now where Fine Gael are going to try and sow as much doubt as possible. Some of it may stick, some of it may not, but they're going to try and hurt Catherine Connolly.
And at the time of recording, there's a debate on drive time Thursday evening, 5 o'clock, which we haven't heard yet, so we don't know how it goes. But it strikes me, Paul, they're going to have to, the two women left in the race and the campaign, they're going to have to take it to each other. It's not enough to have your campaigns, you know, throwing lines around and engage with each other in a way that we haven't really seen happen yet, I think.
And maybe because there are only two candidates, that will become more likely. I think within the scenario you're describing there, I think if we believe that the poll was right, and there'll be another poll on this Sunday, we believe from the Business Post, then Catherine Connolly is in the lead. So therefore, she's more on a maintaining position. If it is that the poll was right, then it's Heather Humphreys who has to gather ground, in which case it puts more an onus on her to go after. So it could be that rather than the two contenders going after each other, it could be that Catherine Connolly tries to stay above the fray and Heather Humphreys is the one who's throwing the punches, politically speaking.
And I know that there's a bookie firm that has paid out already on the outcome, Micheál, saying Catherine Connolly is going to win. But the thing about campaigns is you never know what's coming next. Who'd have thunk last week? Who knows this time next week what will have happened?
And the heat that's involved, and judging by what's happening today, I mean, a bookie paying out really can be about marketing as well. And they would have some money in the bank from the early bets that would have gone on Jim Gavin as well. So there's a bit of space fiscally there to do that.
Fiscal space.
It's a bit of an insult to voters, though, isn't it? I mean, you know, it ain't all over till they've gone to the polls and had their say. Of course, the question's going to be how many of them go to the polls. Will it match the, what was it last time, 43%? When we all knew what the outcome would be.
It's potentially going to be, I mean, some predictions it'll be below 40%. It's also a bank holiday Friday. That's not going to help things because people are going away.
Something like that.
I think the forecast is maybe, I think
I can't believe anything beyond 5 days now. The weather is a chaotic system.
But it's also, it's a bank holiday weekend.
There's no weather person in the race either, though.
That's the Halloween bank holiday weekend. Yes. So there'll be lots of people heading off. And
just before midterms.
Yes.
Midterm break
schools. Off to the jazz festival.
Oh, that's the one. All going to Cork. All roads lead to Cork.
Says Sandra from Cork.
Yes.
Who's wearing a red top.
Before we... oh, yes, actually, one thing I wanted to say also about the presidential. We've had Maria Steen out again this week saying that the election should be going ahead. We've had Declan Ganley, who was also a would-be candidate, saying that people should spoil their vote. Do you think there's much momentum to any of that naysaying, don't let the establishment take this away, the democratic deficit of this election, that we're just down to these two
candidates? Yeah, there's something there. I don't know. I suppose the Pádraig Tobin point that Sandra referenced earlier was interesting, that not to go behind the Fianna Fáil candidate. So does it just become the spoiled vote, that will be the measure of it? But there were protests here last week, or demonstration to that point, but not this week. So I'm not sure.
So there'll be the polls. And again, the other thing to watch about the polls, it's the point you were making, Paul. It's not just what the polls are saying. It's who comes out to vote, who's going to be bothered enough to vote that bank holiday Friday weekend.
If you're from Fine Gael, you'll be hoping that a lot of Catherine Connolly supporters from younger voters, and younger voters traditionally don't always come out, where you know, older voters do, and therefore that might favour. But I think it's pretty clear Heather Humphreys is the person who's under pressure to make ground. She is an experienced politician. Maybe she can do it. But also, if you start throwing too many punches, you can come across in a way that doesn't be attractive to voters, yeah, and you can end up losing. So it's a tricky balance.
One final point before we go, Paul, and my final question to the three candidates, as then was last Sunday, was about how they'd flatter Donald Trump if he comes to Doonbeg for the Irish Open next year. And as we speak, it appears that Donald Trump may be on the way to the Nobel Prize, the Nobel Peace Prize that he craves, because he appears to have at last forced the Israelis to stop the bombing of Gaza. What happens next, we don't quite know.
Yeah, when Donald Trump came into office, he was very strongly pro-Israel, saying he was a more pro-Israel than Joe Biden. And that's pretty tough going, because Joe Biden was a lifetime supporter of the State of Israel. I think the moment in which Israel bombed Hamas leaders who were assessing a Donald Trump peace plan was probably a key pivot in which changed his mind about what he needed to do. We know that he can be a bully, and it seems that's what he's done to both Mr. Netanyahu and Hamas, into saying this is it, this is the deal, this is as good as it's going to get. And at the moment, as we're looking here, the first phase is looking good. It looks as good that there will be a ceasefire. It looks good that hostages will be released, although there's question marks over those who are dead, whether they're actually going to be able to find them. But beyond that, we've had a ceasefire before. When it came to further implementation, it began to sunder. Mm-hmm. And so I think if the progress is going to continue, it will require the personal interest of Donald Trump. If he takes his eye off the ball, then the whole thing could sunder.
But interesting that Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, was back in the frame for these peace talks, along with his envoy, Steve Witkoff, both men, of course, known for their real estate interests, and President Trump having spoken about potential of the Gaza coastline for real estate development.
Absolutely. And another person who's back is Tony Blair, who's also been part of drafting that 20-point peace plan and could have some role in how Gaza is ruled. And given his record in Iraq, for many people, they're just saying, how is that possible?
All right, we leave it there. Any fuckle square? No?
No.
It's very quiet.
No light spots. No light this week.
All right, we'll talk to you next Thursday. Bye.